reproductive autonomy, right? Someone's ability to exercise reproductive autonomy and access life-saving medicine should never depend on their income. And fortunately, British Columbia has been a huge leader on this, and it's been great to see the very positive results.
This policy has been, as you said, very successful in British Columbia. You mentioned some numbers and the more quantitative impacts. How impactful would you say access to free contraception has been here in BC?
It's enormous, right? So not only do we have people using prescription contraception to prevent unplanned pregnancy or to time their births, but I think a lot of people, especially men, often forget that prescription contraception is prescribed for a wide range of reasons. Often chronic gynecological conditions like PMDD and PCOS and endometriosis, for hormonal acne, for menstrual regulation, for preventing against some forms of cancer, and for gender-affirming care. So there's a whole wide range of reasons why you might be prescribed prescription contraception by your doctor. And those are all valid, and they're all reasons why the medication should be free. And it's also worth underscoring a bunch of other points too. Like one of them is that, when it comes to contraception, we want to have people to have choice. Not everyone's bodies are the same. Not everyone's lifestyles are the same. You want someone to have a range of options that can accommodate whatever is going on in their life. And when you make prescription contraception free, it allows people to explore and experiment with the type that works best with their body. And what we've seen from this recent research at the University of British Columbia is that it also means that people are able to access more reliable forms of contraception, like IUDs, which is fantastic news. One other bit of interesting information was that before prescription contraception was made free here in British Columbia, 37% of people were paying out of pocket for prescription contraception. That number is now down to 13%, or it was in June 2024. And that's really significant. A lot of people may have coverage through work or through their school or through their parents, but they're still paying out of pocket. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is privacy. If you're on your parents' plan, you may not want to tell your parents you're using prescription contraception, and so people pay out of pocket. And the other reason is because a lot of people who are using prescription contraception to prevent against unplanned pregnancy are younger folks, and the only contraception, the only prescription they may be buying that year is prescription contraception. And as a result, they don't hit their deductibles, so they're still paying out of pocket. And so it's still a barrier for people. I will say that cost is not the only barrier preventing people from accessing contraception. So our campaign, now that we have the policy set up here in British Columbia, we'll be launching a new campaign this fall focused on improving pain management for IUD insertions. So we want to remove additional barriers. There's direct cost, there's indirect cost. It's having to travel distances, especially in rural and remote communities, the need to take time off work or school, the need for childcare. Those are all additional indirect costs. But then you also have stigma and taboo and misinformation and disinformation. And on top of that, the need for effective pain management for some of the procedures. So we'll be launching that campaign this fall, and we're hoping to urge the government to improve some of their processes to make it easier for people to access pain management. And that's been really good news. And we're hoping to see this policy rolled out across the country. So what we've been working on now that the policy has been adopted here in British Columbia, in addition to working to expand it here, has been to spread it across Canada. And we had a lot of initial success. Manitoba became the second province to adopt free contraception last fall. And Bill C-64 was adopted by the federal government prior to the last federal election. Bill C-64 is the National Pharmacare Plan, and that's the plan that proposes free prescription contraception and free diabetes medicine and supplies across the country. That was adopted, and the next step was that the federal government needed to enter into negotiations with each of the provinces to finalize how much money was being exchanged, etc. Manitoba was the first province to sign on, followed by BC. These provinces both already had the policy in place. I'm sure the communication and the conversation negotiations was a little bit easier. PEI signed on, and then Yukon will be implementing the policy before the end of the year. And then the federal election hit. And our hope was that following the federal election, the federal government would step up and follow through on negotiating agreements with the remaining provinces. Unfortunately, this week, we've just heard from the Carney government that they have no intention of negotiating new agreements. So only 17% of Canadians, those in BC, Manitoba, PEI, and Yukon, are going to be able to enjoy the National Pharmacare Plan. Not much of a National Pharmacare Plan now, is it now? And the rest of folks won't. Now, there's nothing stopping provinces from implementing this policy on their own. It is a fantastic policy. It is revenue positive. It saves governments money. So any province could do what Manitoba and BC did, which was to step up and implement the policy tomorrow. And they should. But the fact that the federal government is effectively stepping away from further negotiations, to me, underscores it's very devastating to a national pharmacare plan. Our hope was that they would start with contraception and diabetes medicine and supplies, and then implement the next stage, which was rare diseases, and then keep going, because you shouldn't have to reach for your wallet when it comes to accessing life-saving medicine. And your ability to, you know, you go to the doctor for free, but you can't pay for your prescription, that's a problem. So we're hoping to rectify that. But it seems that the Carney government is signaling the opposite, that they're kind of abandoning the National Pharmacare Plan, and they'll maintain the agreements that are in place, but they're not going to be negotiating new ones. And that is terrible news and a massive disappointment.
Right. And so for folks who are interested, who believe in pharmacare and a national pharmacare plan, who want to take some sort of action on this, what is Access BC doing?
Yeah, just yesterday we launched a national letter writing campaign to send letters to the Prime Minister, and it'll also copy in people's Member of Parliament. If you're interested in signing up, folks who are listening, that's at accessbc.org, and it takes a few seconds to send a letter. There are those form letter things. You can, of course, add your own experiences, but it only takes a few seconds, and our hope is to really flood the Prime Minister's inbox with emails. My hope is that the news that we heard this week was the federal Liberals sort of testing the waters as to whether backing away from pharmacare was going to be acceptable to Canadians. So we need to send a very powerful message that it is not okay. And I hope that if we send that message, and we send that message in mass, that we'll see the government hopefully backpedaling and ideally negotiating more agreements with the provinces. But this isn't the only bad news we've had around gender equality this month. The other news we've heard was that the Carney government's looking for 15% cuts in departments across the board, except the Department of Women and Gender Equality, which is getting an 80% cut to their budget for 2028. That's also devastating news. So you're starting to pile on disappointing failures when it comes to gender equality with the new Carney government, and I'm very alarmed by that. The other news that we heard was a $1 billion cut to Health Canada funding, looking forward to 2028. And that's, again, really bad news. So it seems that we have a federal government that's thoroughly distracted by international trade and tariff issues and is throwing Canadians under the bus and leaving people in very dire situations where they can't access life-saving and life-changing medicine, and undermining gender equality, and that's not okay.
Nationalized healthcare, free healthcare in Canada is a big part of the Canadian identity. It's a big part of the way Canadians think about themselves and differentiate themselves from particularly Americans. What is your sort of read on how Canadians feel about the federal pharmacare program and the Liberal government's current attitude towards that?
Yeah, great, great point. And yes, absolutely. Reproductive justice, gender equality, and healthcare are core Canadian values. And so to me, it seems a little bit ironic when we have a federal government trying to juxtapose Canadian values against American values, where, by the way, the United States was proposing burning, was it $10 million of contraception that was destined for foreign aid that's, you know, being, you know, stored in a warehouse somewhere in Europe. So if you're trying to juxtapose your values against the horrific fascist Trump regime, then you should do a better job, in my opinion, as far as with the federal government doing. So I think that's really important. And when you ask Canadians what they think about free prescription contraception, they overwhelmingly support the policy. The polls that were done a couple years back showed like well over 80% of people support this, with good reason, right? Like the policy, again, it improves health outcomes, it makes life more affordable, it makes life more equal, and it saves governments money. I think that's something I want to really underscore here. We're talking about preventative medicine, and we have a Carney government that's really set on tightening budgets. But this is a time to invest in preventative medicine. A study from Dr. Wendy Norman from the Contraception and Abortion Research Team at the University of British Columbia estimated that free prescription contraception is going to save British Columbia around $27 million a year. There was an older study from 2015 published in the Canadian Association Medical Journal that estimated that the policy would save Canada around $320 million a year. And that's just in the direct costs associated with unplanned pregnancy. So this is something that we should definitely be investing in. And when it comes to pharmacare, like more broadly, not just free prescription contraception, that argument still holds out, right? Like we want happy, healthy people able to live their best lives. And the idea of having, you know, free public health care, but then not being able to actually fill the prescription your doctor gives me seems just absolutely off the wall to me. It's all about trying to keep people happy and healthy. And when you invest in these programs, they work. And that's what we're seeing from not just the research that's hot off the press from UBC, but research, reams of research going back decades.
It's interesting that, you know, the aphorism, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is rooted in medicine and yet seems to be being ignored, or at least sort of pushed to the wayside.
Absolutely. And I mean, my big worry here is this ongoing trend of the Carney government really not taking gender equality and reproductive health issues all that seriously. And that's really worrying. I think a lot of people, well, I'm not sure what a lot of people were thinking when they put the Carney government and they voted for the Carney government, but I don't think this is what they thought they'd get. I don't think people were expecting neoliberal austerity cuts savaging their way across fundamental and core Canadian policies. And I mean, this is a huge disappointment, particularly around pharmacare, because here's a government that literally started this policy. The bill was passed, negotiations were beginning. We have some provinces that are a bit more reluctant to adopt the policy. I'm looking at you, Alberta. I'm looking at you, Ontario. Maybe Saskatchewan. Not sure what most thinking these days. But then we also have some provinces that were exploring doing the policy. Premier Holt in New Brunswick, it was in her platform when she was elected as the new premier of New Brunswick, and their government is working on the policy. They're just taking a bit longer than we might like. And I've heard similar rumblings from Newfoundland and Labrador, right? Those are two provinces that could be getting on board with this policy if the federal government was negotiating with any level of enthusiasm. What we need at this point around pharmacare is a federal government that's going to show actual leadership and step up and work with the outstanding provinces to adopt this important policy, not one that's going to back away. But unfortunately, what we're hearing from the Carney government is they're backing away, and that's really not okay.
All right. So if listeners want to get involved with the pharmacare shouldn't depend on your postal code letter writing campaign, how can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So people can head over to accessbc.org. It takes a few seconds to send a letter. We're asking folks to share that with their friends. If you're hearing this story, please tell your friends about it. It's a really short notice letter writing campaign, and it's important. We really need to signal to the federal government that they need to follow through on their promises and that your ability to access life-saving and life-changing medicine should not depend on your income or where you live.
All right. Well, thanks, Teal, for taking the time to talk about this really important issue.
Always a pleasure chatting with you, and I hope you're having a great day.
Yeah, likewise. Take care.
Hi, we're Your Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
See you. broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Hello once more from the Skagit Valley Highland Games. I have with me the president of the SFU Pipe Band. If you could introduce yourself for Radioland.
Yes, hello listeners. It's Rob McNeil, president of the SFU Pipe Band Society.
Excellent. And SFU, a few bands kind of from the Vancouver area have competed over these weekends. We have, of course, the Grade 1 band, the SFU Pipe Band. We also have our Grayland Crossing Band, which is from the Vancouver area, and the Robert Malcolm Memorial Band. And it's just so nice to hear a wide range all the way from Grade 5 to Grade 1 and hear how everybody's evolving over time and just getting better and contributing to the art.
Yes, certainly. It's not just the bands from BC. The ones from Washington State and Oregon have been doing very well and well represented today at the games and giving all the bands a good challenge.
Absolutely. We had Cascadia Pipe Band. They always do excellent. They're in Grade 2. And then Portland Metro.
Yes. The Cascadia's got a Grade 2 and a Grade 4 band.
Excellent.
And Portland Metro has a Grade 3 band and a Grade 4 band, the youth band.
Excellent. Yes. We briefly connected at Scott Fest in Coquitlam a few weeks back, and there are many Highland Games throughout the Pacific Northwest, Victoria, in the Vancouver area, in Seattle, in the interior in Okanagan as well. And this is kind of the last event before the World Championships for the band.
Not quite. We've got Enumclaw.
Okay. Enumclaw. Excellent.
In 2 weeks.
Excellent.
And that's the last one. Typically the last one before the band heads over to the Worlds.
Excellent.
Each year.
And that's over in Glasgow, kind of in the beginning of August.
Correct.
The second week?
Second? Yeah, the second weekend. Yeah. There. Typically it's second, third. It depends what the calendar is like.
Yeah. Yes. And which bands from SFU are competing at that event?
Just the Simon Fraser University Pipe Band. The Robert Malcolm won't be going over to Scotland this year.
Excellent. And speaking of competing at the Worlds, we were treated to some new music, some new tunes, both a new MSR, March, Strathspey, and Reel, as well as a new medley. And I've been really enjoying hearing the new medley. It's nice and tight and crisp. And it's technical in a lovely way.
Yes, it's a great medley. And the players love putting it together, love playing it. It just shows because the music comes out so easily from them on this.
Mm-hmm. And some key players, of course, Reed Maxwell leading up drums and Alan Bevan as well. And it's a nice mix of seasoned players as well as kind of players that have moved up from bands in the past few years.
That's right. Yeah, we have some new younger players in the organization that have come in the last couple of years and even just this past year in the drum corps. And again, one of them is a daughter of one of the pipers. So it continues this tradition of family members coming and playing with their parents in the band.
Ah, yeah. So good. So good. Of course, the World Championships in Glasgow is kind of the pinnacle of the piping calendar. Bands from all over the world, from North America, from Australia, of course, from the UK, Scotland, the European continent. And SFU has been a six-time champion and multiple-time champion of both drumming and piping as well as overall bands. So we are gunning for you, as always. We're the home team, the home crowd. And for events that are kind of coming up on the calendar, what can people expect?
Well, we will be, after the world's taking basically a small break, and we've got, of course, the convocation that will be coming up in October. It's been a busy year for convocation with the addition of the Monday afternoon session, so it's very full, so we're looking forward to playing in slightly cooler climates, let's say, there. But of course, with the universities going to be celebrating its 60th anniversary, the band is working on a couple things where we're going to be reaching out to some of the old alumni that used to play in the SFU Pipe Band prior to 1981, when the city of Port Moody became the new SFU Pipe Band, we call it. Because those players basically started the Pipe Band decades ago and played in the early convocations. And there's that famous picture that Ceremonies uses of the first convocation in 1967, and you see the two pipers at the start of the procession there.
Wonderful.
And so we're wanting to, some of those players may have passed on by now, but we're wanting to reach out to them and find the ones and talk. We'll talk more about some unique celebrations we're looking at with regard to them.
Absolutely, and we'll keep in touch to keep Radioland and the university and everybody in the community aware of those, because it is a unique part of SFU's history, is our pipe band. Is there anything else that you'd like to let Radioland know about?
Well, that's it for the fall calendar. Yeah. Things, you know, sort of can change as things develop, but the focus has been on the World Championships and playing there. That's been the overall prime focus, and of course the junior round will be coming back in the fall, and we've had some really good recruitment numbers as a result of the Robert Malcolm Man getting out in the parades. For example, the Hayek Parade and the Hats Off Day Parade and several other things that they've done in the community events, various marathons, runs for the cure, and being able to get into school. So there's been a major push with regard to getting more players coming in by getting more out in front of the public and handing out little flyers on how to join. And it's been that, along with the Facebook ads, have been very successful.
Even though I've been following the band for a long time on social media, I get those ads. So they are working. They're getting out to the public. To follow the band, you can, of course, check their social media. I believe it's at SFU Pipe Band for most of it.
Yeah, generally. It's SFU Pipe Band on Facebook and Instagram. And we have our YouTube channel that posts some of the sort of competition performances. But most of the major social media ones are there.
Excellent. Yeah. And for those of you who are interested, of course, come back in early August. The World's SFU Pipe Band Grade 1 will be performing, and we wish them the best. Rob, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to see you, and good luck at Leeds.
Oh, thank you so much.
We'll be right back. Hi, I'm Stuart Little. I'm from Inverary in Scotland, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade, unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience. And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby.
Hi.